Hello and welcome to Radio Retail with me, your host, William Madison. Today on the podcast, we're going to be taking a deep dive into the issue of diversity and inclusion in retail with two experts in the field. It's a topic that's receiving more and more attention, not just within the retail industry, and thankfully the narrative around it is slowly changing. No longer is D&I an issue for HR departments or a box-ticking exercise, but absolutely critical work for everyone within your organization, from top to bottom. But before we get into our first interview, we're going to have a look at the latest stats and trends in our new regular section, The Retail Rundown. We hope you enjoy the show. As I said, in the Retail Rundown, I'll be giving you, the listener, a rundown on the major stats and trends from the retail industry, drawn from our exclusive monitors and reports here at the BRC. So let's get right into it. Starting things off with our retail sales monitor, January like-for-like retail sales were up 8.1% on January last year. Total retail sales are up 11.9% on last year, with the online non-food category up 31.8% on a two-year basis, ticking above the 24.8% three-monthly average, though non-food online penetration rate did drop from 66% last year, when non-essential stores were closed, to 41.5% this year. Looking now to our shop price index, which shows 1.5% inflation overall in shop prices. This is the highest rate of inflation since December 2012, so a pretty significant number there. The biggest driver from this came from food, particularly fresh food, with 2.9% inflation, following on from 3% inflation in December. Food overall sits at 2.7%, the highest inflation rate since October 2013, while non-food inflation accelerated to 0.9%, an increase from 0.2% in December. Turning to footfall, these numbers, remember, are calculated against 2 years ago, being January 2020. As you remember, we were in a strict lockdown in January 2021, so doesn't bear comparing. With this in mind, the total retail footfall index was down 17.1%, staying around that three-monthly average of 17.3% decline. High streets and shopping centres were the hardest hit, with 24.2% and 37.5% declines respectively, while retail parks fared a little better, sitting at a decline of 13%. Not great numbers there, but probably within the expected range given the ongoing impacts of COVID this January. Finally, looking at our shop vacancies monitor, overall vacancies sits at 14.4% in Q4, down 0.1% on Q3 of last year. The good news here, though, is that none of the locations we monitor saw an increase in vacancies in Q4. Shopping centre vacancies are down 0.3% to 19.1%. High streets are down 0.1% to 14.4%, and retail parks remained at 11.3%. By far the location with the lowest vacancy rates, which is obviously in line with the results from our footfall monitor. It's been a long wait for shop vacancies to fall. This last came in Q1 of 2018, so that's some very positive news for the industry out there, and hopefully a signal that the most damaging effects of the lockdowns are now over. If you want a deeper dive into the latest stats, facts, and trends from the industry, you can visit us at brc.org.uk/communities/insight, where you'll find all of these reports and more work from our insights team here at the BRC. And now, enough with the numbers, and on to our interviews of the day. Coming up, we have an in-depth conversation with Kelly Thompson, partner at RPC and specialist in workplace engagement and equality. But first, we had a quick chat with our own chief executive, Helen Dickinson OBE, on our diversity and inclusion charter and how you, the listener, can get involved and make a difference in your workplace. And I'm joined now by Helen Dickinson OBE, chief executive of the BRC. Helen, welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, Will.
So today we're going to be talking, well, the whole episode actually is talking about diversity and inclusion. I know it's one of your major focuses for your work here at the BRC. At the center of this is, of course, the D&I Charter. Can you tell us a little bit about what that charter is?
Well, the whole idea behind the charter came from a part of our strategy review, which we undertook last year. We went out to all our members and asked them what the big issues were that they were dealing with at the moment. And along with the environment and sustainability, diversity, inclusion, equity, whatever words you want to use, whatever initials, D&I, IND, IED, all sorts of acronyms, but everybody without fail pretty much mentioned that this was high on their agenda. And therefore, what we wanted to do as part of the BRC was to build that into our strategy. So we identified the charter as a mechanism to mobilize momentum across the membership to really get people to align behind a set of goals, principles that they wanted to commit to aspire to, that would provide a framework such that we could get retailers to perhaps collaborate a bit more closely than they have done before in order to drive change across the industry on inclusivity and diversity, because there are some gaps, particularly at senior levels, where the industry has got some progress to make.
So on that detail there, first off, what are the concrete promises that business make by signing on to the charter?
Well, there are six promises that companies are making. One of the most important ones is about leadership, because it always comes from the top, so that the CEO is accountable for that program of change, putting D&I at the heart of their business strategy. And then the other five commitments are a lot around bias, ensuring that there isn't any, about all of what I call the underpins, the things that every business needs to get right from how they recruit people to how they develop people, how we'll manage performance within our businesses to ensure that everybody who works within them feels included and involved in the way that the business works and are getting the most out of their jobs and their careers.
And how many signatories do we have so far for the charter?
Well, we have around 70, and the numbers are going up all the time. So that's 70 of a real mix of businesses, from the largest names that we'll all recognize to many smaller businesses. And I think that is a real sign that the agenda is important, irrespective of the type of the size of business that someone works within, or the category of product across the industry that you're selling. It's a really important leadership issue, and it's an issue where there is a disconnect often between the focus that is being put there at leadership level and the perception of people who work in those businesses, and trying to build that momentum to close that gap and really improve the levels of diversity at senior levels is all part of the backdrop to what we're trying to create with people working together on the charter.
And looking on a sort of a wide scope, what's your vision for D&I more broadly in retail? Obviously, as a customer-facing industry, retail's often at the forefront of different societal issues. So do you think that retail can be a leader in the D&I space going forward?
I absolutely think that is where we should be aspiring to. I mean, the industry is the largest private sector employer in the country. So there are 3 million people who work in retail. There's no doubt that we have a diverse workforce, because we are representative of all the communities and the society in which every retail business operates. Part of the key is, though, that we have also quite a high turnover level of people from moving into the industry and leaving it. We have not such good levels of diversity once you get to that more senior level within the industry. So how we address those two things and really move ourselves from good to great is all what sits behind that charter. And that's the aspiration of those businesses that have signed up to it. And that's a recognition by all of them and all of us that there is so much more that we need to do. And so that's what drives the charter on, is that belief that it's where we are at the moment is just not good enough, and we've just got more to do to reach that point that we can all be even more proud of the industry in which we operate.
Absolutely. There's still a long way to go, although it's good to see or good to hear about, you know, positive steps that we're taking going forward. Thanks, Helen, for joining me on the podcast today. I know you're busy working on this and many other things at the moment. So thanks for jumping on, and hopefully talk again soon.
Thank you.
Thanks again there to Helen for coming on the podcast. And finally, now we turn to our conversation with Kelly Thompson from RPC. In a wide-ranging conversation, we talked about why business leaders need to act now on diversity and inclusion, what some of the areas are that we still lack understanding, and what concrete steps we can take to improve work culture and hiring practices. We hope you enjoy the conversation. And I'm joined now by Kelly Thompson, partner at RPC, focusing on employment, engagement, and equality, as well as the host of the widely acclaimed podcast, The Fix. Welcome to the podcast, Kelly.
Thanks, William. It's lovely to be here.
Lovely to have you. Now, Kelly, today we're going to be talking about diversity and inclusion. I'm going to start us off with the business case. Potentially in the past, D&I might have been seen within businesses as a matter for the HR department. Thankfully, I think we're moving past this, and businesses are starting to see why it's important at every level. So I just wanted to lay the groundwork here. Why is diversity and inclusion critical? And why should every business and every business leader care and be thinking about it?
Thank you. That's such a great question. And I couldn't agree more with that sort of shift from focusing on the business case. We used to talk so much in DEI workshops and training sessions about the business case, because there is a business case, isn't there? We know there's loads of research that shows that diverse teams outperform homogenous teams. There's a legal case, clearly, not least avoiding discrimination claims. So it's there. But I like you, I think there's been a sort of sea change in the conversation away from justifying this towards, okay, how do we actually achieve this? And I always say, Michelle and I, who I co-host my podcast that you mentioned with, always say, like, there's no business case for the status quo. No one has ever says, can you set out for me the underlying business case for not changing this?
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, so I think that's a really positive move. But you're absolutely right. I think that lots of the retailers that we've been working with through the BRC and lots of our clients generally have really come to understand over the kind of preceding few years that this is more than just an additional kind of add-on, a thing to do when times are good and you might have a bit of spare money and time in the pot, imagine, but actually something that's as critical to your business as watching the finances, as kind of having operational plans, as keeping an eye on the future generally. And some of that is future-proofing, actually, because there are all these macro changes that, you know, all of your listeners will know about better than me. They're living them, at the coalface, as it were, in their businesses. Things like the technological revolution, which is, you know, here, it's not coming. We're in the middle of it, right? And I think the pandemic has sort of advanced that, obviously, quite rapidly in lots of ways. But the reality is, you know, given that the World Economic Forum estimate that I think about half of all jobs will be changed by automation in 10 years time, but that only about 5% will be gone altogether. So what that means is so many jobs will be fundamentally different in quite a short period of time. So if you want your business to survive and thrive, the reality is that the differentiator is going to be that human bit, the ability to work with different people, to get the best out of different people, to kind of harness that talent and that innovation. And that's what DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, is really all about at heart. It's about getting the best out of your people and creating environments where they give the best. And that'll be the same as well with, you know, and you know, obviously a bricks and mortar retailers will always continue to have a sort of in-person footprint within the country, but retailers obviously won't be immune from workforces more broadly becoming more global, and that the need to kind of engage with people who are from different backgrounds to you, who've got different experiences to you, to get the best out of them. So again, just operationally, this stuff is going to be really critical to kind of that future-proofing side of things, not to mention customers demanding it and other stakeholders like investors.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to serve a diverse and varied customer base, difficult to do that if everyone in the room creating the products, thinking about how you advertise them, is from a very small kind of group of people. It sort of stands to reason, the more differences of opinion and approaches in the room, the less likely you are to end up in a kind of groupthink type territory, and better able you are to spot those gaps in the market that you could best serve. So it just makes business sense. Having said, let's not talk about the business case. I'm now concluding.
Yeah.
It just makes business sense.
Well, I think, but that, I mean, that is the point. It is a win-win, and is, you know, it's becoming more and more urgent that we're making changes now to support it. So, you know, understanding that that's the business case, there's also a huge scope to the challenges and the improvements that we need to make. So what is it that we can do now, and what are the elements of the challenge that maybe listeners and ourselves as well need to understand better?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I think, and I kind of hold myself to account for this as well as a practitioner in this space, I think there can be a tendency inadvertently to kind of make this sound like you have to have done 3 PhDs in it before you can even come anywhere near talking about it. And by the way, by the time you've done that, we've changed all the language anyway, so you're already out of date. And I don't think anyone does that deliberately, but you've just got people really passionately focused on this topic all the time. And like any other area, any other discipline, it has its own language. And I think for me, what I always say and what we talk about a lot in our sessions with the BRC members in this space is actually, this is everyone's business. Everyone influences it. And it should be like something that you can grasp onto and understand and become at least literate in without having to learn a new language, essentially. And I think some of that is kind of just some common understanding around the terminology. So I don't know whether it would help, but I feel like we bandy around the letters D, E, I, B, J sometimes, justice. And actually, I think oftentimes people are meaning something slightly different. So diversity for me is about difference. So diversity in a workplace context is about different characteristics, whether that's gender, socioeconomic background, diversity of thought, experience, ethnicity, sexuality, so on and so forth. And it's about bringing that variety in, which is obviously hugely important for any business, but particularly for a customer-facing business. You need to represent the kind of clients you serve. But it's kind of about representation. Put really crudely, it's like bums on seats. So it's important, but it's just one jigsaw piece. And sometimes we get really bogged down in that jigsaw piece, actually, because it's the one that's easy to measure. A lot of the kind of the pressure from regulators in other industries and kind of legislation is focused on numbers, on counting. But actually, I focus much more, and we do in our discussions with the BRC members, around inclusion, because that's about basically harnessing the benefit of that difference. Because, you know, if you've got a homogenous organization where everyone looks, speaks, sounds similar, has the same experiences, and then you go out on a hiring mission and bring in a load of people that look, sound, are different, have different experiences, but you do nothing culturally to create an inclusive culture, you're quite probably making it really hard for that person to come into that environment and bring their unique experiences to bear in the most positive way for them and the business. And you might keep them for a while, but then you might lose them, and you might find that you've got this kind of constant stream of attrition. Because actually, what you need to focus in on, if I can put my teeth in, is how do we ensure that difference that we want that person for isn't something that we then accommodate, and we like them even though they've got this different thing, but that we actually celebrate and we say, it's great that you're bringing a different perspective. Tell us that different perspective. That's exactly what we need. Yeah. You don't have to change yourself to fit into this other kind of description of good that you can see around you. And then the next step, the E, the equity, is about, it's about recognizing that, because we used to have this kind of view, I think, that equality was about fair treatment in the sense of, if you treat everyone the same, or if you treat everyone how you would like to be treated, then that's kind of fair. But equity is about saying that works to a degree, but it only works if you and I start at the same starting line. If we start on the same starting line and we're given exactly the same opportunities, then great, that's fair. But if through nothing of our own actions, just who we were born, where we were born, sorry, or our own kind of capabilities or physical differences or any number of other characteristics, we start at different points on that starting line. If we're treated the same, then what? I'm never going to catch you up. So there are occasions where removing barriers or creating kind of environments that are that people can navigate with those differences is the only way to ensure fairness. So it's not about people jumping the queue or kind of upending the hierarchy. It's about kind of removing stuff that sort of shouldn't be there anyway, if we were designing the world from scratch, but we don't have time to design the world from scratch. So trying to be pragmatic about it in a workplace context.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, you know, a lot of listeners, and this actually goes to myself as well, can often be quite skeptical of conversations around D&I within businesses. You know, for the specific reason that historically there's been a lot of talk, but maybe not the same level of action to back it up and to make the progress that we really want to see. So talking real concrete things that listeners can do now, what are some of the practical steps that we can take on our own in our own workplaces?
Yeah, I love it. And absolutely. And I always try with any kind of client work and workshops and stuff, I sort of set myself the challenge of I tend to find that organizations are interested in hearing like the academic research and their kind of principles behind it. But I always say to myself, I'm not going to tell anyone about a problem or bring up a problem or an issue if I don't then move into the solutions, because we're all busy. And ultimately, I don't want people to leave the room of a workshop feeling depressed, like it's just too big an issue. I'm never going to, what's the point? I can't influence it. So absolutely. I'll talk about a couple of practical examples, but the one thing I would say as an overarching point is that small steps can make a big difference, or micro practices can create macro change, you might say. And that couldn't be more true for me in the DEI space. And the reason it couldn't be more true is it's all about organizational culture. So you might set a cult, the leaders of a business will set the tone of the culture hugely, but then every single person in that business is contributing to it every minute of every day that they are doing something work related. So when you, just to give an example, if I dial into my team meeting later on this afternoon, there's 10 of us in the meeting, for example, and I have a choice as to how I show up in that meeting as one of the partners. You know, if I interrupt people, that sends them a message. If I don't make sure that everyone gets a say, that is creating or not creating an inclusive culture. If I take over the whole thing, what message is that sending about how much I care about people's opinions? If we're talking about who does certain amounts of certain jobs that have come in, if they all get delegated to the same person, I'm not creating the opportunities over here. So I'm not going into that meeting necessarily. Well, I might be, because you know, I'm obsessed with this topic, but you're not necessarily going into those meetings thinking this is a meeting about DEI.
Yeah.
This is a meeting where I have the opportunity to demonstrate diversity and inclusion and that it's important to me. You're just doing your job as a leader or a manager or an employee, whatever your role is. But there are, if you approach it with that mindset of how do I ensure within my sphere of influence that the people that I'm now with can be their best selves? What can I do to open that up? And then it can happen in things like if you witness what we might call a microaggression, which is basically, it doesn't tend to be something that would kind of reach the level of like harassment or discrimination, but we call them sort of death by a thousand cuts. So it might be if you're in a wheelchair and somebody thinks, I'll help you, I'll push that wheelchair for you. Like, it's done with the best of intentions, but most of the time that person in the wheelchair would feel violated. It's like the equivalent of me picking somebody up and kind of carrying them.
Sure.
It's a real sense of like, you don't have autonomy. Or comments like, oh, I love afro hairs. Is it really difficult to look after? Or, you know, things that are on the face of it, they're not intended to be offensive, but actually over time, people can feel really worn down by. Now, if I witness something like that, if any of us witness something like that, we have an opportunity as a kind of bystander to be what you might call an active bystander and find an opportunity to say to that person, do you know what? I'm not sure that was received that well. You might want to chat to them and see how they feel about it, or to take the other person to one that says, were you okay? I wasn't sure if that was an all right conversation.
Yeah.
And just kind of, you know, it's easier often as the bystander to kind of almost intervene, and not to create a big issue necessarily, not to kind of be because in 9.5 times out of 10, no offense was intended, and that person would be absolutely mortified to discover that they'd upset somebody.
Absolutely.
If you never have the conversation, how can they? So those are the sort of day-to-day things. And I think what I would say from a more, you know, if you're somebody who has more kind of day-to-day responsibility for this, if you're in the HR team, if you're an IND professional, I think my key point, as I say, is that is focusing on the inclusion,
yeah,
the lived experience of the people in the organization, and let diversity and representation be the output of that work. So get the inclusive culture right. Focus on, yes, on the policies that you've got. Yeah. Yes, on the practices, but also on day to day, like what behaviors are we rewarding? What behaviors are we encouraging? What are the kind of unwritten rules about the way things are done around here? Do we have a policy that says everyone can work flexibly, but in reality, you know that these managers over here will never allow it? Because that's then their team's lived experience, doesn't matter what you've got written down.
Yeah.
It's kind of focusing on those things. And then, as I say, let representation and diversity be more the beautiful output of that work rather than the kind of tunnel vision. Do you see what I mean? It's sort of, it's almost just kind of turning it on its head. There's a couple of really sort of specific examples we've talked about in terms of recruitment, which I always come back to because I think they're so sort of compellingly simple. So there's some research that Harvard Business Review published around shortlists for recruitment, and it was looking at gender diversity in shortlists. And they did this experiment with a shortlist of four, and they kind of manipulated how many men and women were in this shortlist. And they discovered that if you had three women and one man in the shortlist, there was about a 75% chance that a woman would be recruited, which kind of makes sense statistically.
Sure.
Then if it was two and two, there was about a 50% chance again. And then it kind of dropped and dropped. When you got down to one woman on a shortlist and three men, there was basically a 0% chance that the woman would be recruited. It was statistically such an insignificant amount. It was basically zero. And we don't 100% know, you know, there's still kind of studies and research, I think, around what might be behind that. But what one theory is, it's almost like you're kind of almost pointing out that person's difference. You're highlighting that it would be a bit of a different call there to recruit the woman. But one thing about that is, okay, well, if you take research like that, what's a practical step you can take? All right, always aim to never have just one woman on the shortlist.
Yeah.
Or because you know you're creating this kind of risk. Similarly, there's other research that looks at salary negotiations and looks at the fact that if you, as a business, advertise a job and are silent about salary, silent about whether it's negotiable, so you just start, you put nothing or you put a figure in, then what tends to happen is men are more likely to seek to negotiate the salary, even though it doesn't sort of invite that. Women less so. Whereas if you simply say salary negotiable, then it kind of evens out, and men and women, it's almost like women statistically, I appreciate this is a generalization, but the research would suggest women almost need the invitation to have that conversation, which makes sense because we know innately women are kind of, they're in this double bind of trying to tread a line between not being too confident, being likable but not too likable, being confident but not too confident. And so, you know, and I always say to organizations, like, either make it negotiable or know that in not putting that, potentially you're perpetuating a gender pay gap, because you've got the possibility of people starting out on those different salaries purely because of that sort of innate approach to those kinds of negotiations. So there's loads of practical stuff. It's working out, what's your sphere of influence? Are you looking at recruitment? Are you looking at promotion? Are you looking at reducing attrition? Is there an area of the business where you need more ethnicities, more diversity from an ethnicity perspective? Diagnose the problem and then kind of hone in on the solutions. Don't think of I&D as one global mountain to climb. Think of it as a series of elements of your business that have that as an aspect alongside finance and ops and every other business imperative, and focus in on what you're working on, and then it becomes a manageable job. Just about.
yeah absolutely. I guess well, in other concrete actions that listeners can take, especially for BRC members, I should say, that revolves around the BRC's D&I charter, which is a commitment retail organizations can take to improve D&I in their businesses through a series of practical changes. We're also delighted to be partnering with RPC on the charter. And Kelly, I know you've been involved in some of the roundtables that we've been having with business leaders that have signed on already. Can you tell us a little bit about how those have gone and maybe what they've been on?
Yeah, I have to say, we've absolutely loved doing those sessions. It's been such a pleasure to be able to hear from so many different retailers about their challenges, the kind of opportunities that they found, the issues that they're grappling with. And I mean, I just think this is a space where everybody's learning from each other. No, if anyone tries to tell you they've got all the answers, then they're not telling the truth. is the reality, because there's no silver bullet to it. And I think so what we've done with the sessions, rather than taking what might be more of a sort of traditional lawyer's approach to it and said, okay, we'll talk about gender, we'll talk about disability discrimination, we'll do one about mental health, we thought, well, you know, if you're working in a retail organization, that's not how you approach your people. You don't silo them into particular characteristics. We wanted to design the sessions to be business focused. You know, what as a business would you be thinking about, and when would this come into it? So we've said, well, let's look at the employment life cycle. Let's start with recruitment. So we've done kind of two deep dive sessions actually around recruitment and the levers that you can pull to kind of make a positive difference here around recruitment. And we've based these all around the pledges in the BRC charter, which is brilliant. And then we've done one around audit and the importance of actually tracking what you're changing and tracking what you're doing and tweaking and improving in that cycle. We've looked at promotion and opportunities, and we've kind of tried to hone in, as I say, on like different aspects of the employment life cycle. Mm. And now we're looking at culture and values, obviously that umbrella that crosses over the whole piece. And the beauty of those sessions for me is it's both an opportunity for people to kind of learn from each other and share and network with peers and just sort of try and move the dial together within the sector. But also, I think there's something really great about, because let's be realistic, even if your job is in this space in an organization, you will have multiple things to do in any given day, week, month, and the business will have a million different things. And so actually prioritizing any bit of your job, it's always a juggle, isn't it? What these sessions do, it's a really nice way of us all keeping ourselves honest in a way. It's like, yeah, there's a point at which we will spend an hour and a half totally focused on this. We'll learn from each other. We'll learn, hopefully learn from us, the RPC people, otherwise William's going to kick me out. And we'll kind of go away with some practical actions, and then we'll come back and we'll regroup it with a different heading. And it's kind of like, without wanting to make it all sound like a cult, which it isn't, it's kind of like a journey together. Mm. It's a community that's building up around this shared aim of making a positive difference, albeit recognizing everyone's businesses at a different point in their journey and has different priorities, but there are kind of common themes and ideas we can share. So we're absolutely loving them. We're really looking forward to the next one in a few weeks. And then we're going to be doing some boot camp sessions for members that have joined sort of partway through the first year to catch them up on any sessions that they've missed. And we're planning some cool events and stuff later in the year. So yeah, it's a really good way, I think, to turn the high level pledges into kind of practical, okay, that's great, but what do we actually do? That's our aim behind the workshops. Nice. Turn them into a reality. Yeah,
it's awesome. There's a lot of exciting stuff to come. I think that's where we're going to leave the discussion for today. But I also obviously at the top of the show mentioned, Kelly, that you're the host of the podcast The Fix. Can you tell us a little bit about the podcast and where listeners can find it?
Yeah, thank you. I'll send you that fiver in the post for the plug. So I co-host this podcast, The Fix, with Michelle King, who is a gender equality academic, author, advocate, really. And it's weekly. And what we do is we interview a different guest each time, and they'll be from all walks of life. It's usually with a workplace focus, but sometimes we'll interview people in a completely different context. All of them share something in common, which is that they're taking action, back to our point about actually doing stuff to kind of advance a more equal world, working world, or more broadly. So it can be everybody from politicians, had the Icelandic Prime Minister on there, to actors and advocates, to academics. We look at all sorts of topics. We'll sometimes focus in on very specific ones around, for example, we looked at like attitudes towards leadership and gender globally in different countries and different sectors a couple of weeks ago with in relation to the Reykjavik Index on Leadership. And then we might have one that's around well-being at work, one that's around conversations with people from with different communication styles to you, back to that kind of inclusivity point and how practically can you harness the diversity of approach and thought in your organization. So they're kind of 25 minutes long snapshot. You can listen to them on the walk to the train if you're going into the office. And yeah, I really hope that you find them useful. I have to say I've learned so much from the guests that we've interviewed. I really have. Yeah, they're fantastic.
Yeah, they really are. So yeah, I would encourage all listeners to go have a listen. Brilliant. Thanks again for coming on Radio Retail, Kelly, and hopefully talk again soon.
Thanks for having me. Have a lovely rest of your day.
And our thanks again to Kelly for coming on the podcast. And do check out The Fix. It's a really fantastic podcast, and it was a pleasure to have Kelly on the show. And with that, we come to the end of episode 5 of Radio Retail. If you've been enjoying these podcasts, please don't forget to rate and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening. If you want to find out more about anything we've discussed on the podcast and about the work that we do at the BRC, please visit us at brc.org.uk. Other than that, thank you for listening and goodbye for now.